looking on in polite, curious incomprehension. They could not understand what was going on. Only Bertrand understood. Only he knew the whole story, although he had never discussed it with me since the evening he had discovered the Red Sarah file. He had not even brought it up after having met the Dufour in our apartment a couple of months before. Edouard cleared his throat. Their hands were still clasped. He spoke in English, decent English, with a strong French accent.
I am Edouard Tézac. This is a difficult time to meet you. My mother is dying.
Yes, I'm sorry, said William.
Julia will tell you the whole story, but your mother, Sarah.
Edouard paused. His voice broke. His wife and daughters glanced at him, surprised.
What is all this about?
Murmured Colette, concerned.
Who is Sarah?
This is about something that happened 60 years ago,
said Edouard, fighting to control his voice. I fought an urge to reach out and slip an arm around his shoulder. Edouard took a deep breath, and some color came back into his face. He smiled up at William, a small, timid smile I had not seen him use before.
I will never forget your mother. Never.
His face twitched. The smile vanished, and I saw the pain, the sadness, make him breathe once again with difficulty, like he had on the day he'd told me. The silence grew heavy, unbearable. The women looked on, puzzled.
I am most relieved to be able to tell you this today, all these years later.
William Rainsford nodded.
Thank you, sir,
he said, his voice low. His face was pale, too, I noticed.
I don't know much. I came here to understand. I believe my mother suffered, and I need to know why. We did what we could for her,
said Edouard.
That I can promise you. Julia will tell you. She will explain. She will tell you your mother's story. She will tell you what my father did for your mother. Goodbye.
He drew back, an old man all of a sudden, shrunken and wan. Bertrand's eyes watching him, curious, detached. He had probably never seen his father so moved. I wonder what it did to him, what it meant to him. Edouard walked away, followed by his wife, his daughters, bombarding him with questions. His son trailed after them, hands in pockets, silent. I wondered if Edouard was going to tell Colette and his daughters the truth. Most likely, I thought. And I imagined their shock. William Rainsford and I stood alone in the hall of the nursing home. Outside, on the Rue de Courcelles, it was still raining.
How about some coffee?
He said. He had a beautiful smile. We walked under the drizzle to the nearest cafe. We sat down, ordered 2 espressos. For a moment, we sat there in silence. Then he asked,
Are you close to the old lady?
Yes, I said. Very close.
I see you're expecting a baby.
I patted my plump stomach. Due in February. At last, he said, slowly,
Tell me my mother's story.
This isn't going to be easy, I said.
Yes, but I need to hear it. Please, Julia.
Slowly, I began to talk in a low, hushed voice, only glancing up at him from time to time. As I spoke, my thoughts went to Edouard, probably sitting in his elegant salmon-colored living room on the Rue de l'Université, telling the exact same story to his wife, his daughters, his son. The roundup, the Veldive, the camp, the escape, the little girl who came back, the dead child in the cupboard, 2 families linked by death and a secret, 2 families linked by sorrow. Part of me wanted this man to know the entire truth. Another yearned to protect him, to shield him from blunt reality, from the awful image of the little girl and her suffering, her pain, her loss, his pain, his loss. The more I talked, the more details I gave, the more questions I answered, the more I felt my words enter him like blades and wound him. When I finished, I looked up at him. His face and lips were pale. He took out the notebook from the envelope and gave it to me in silence. The brass key lay on the table between us. I held the notebook between my hands, looking back at him. His eyes egged me on. I opened the book. I read the first sentence to myself. Then I read out loud, translating the French directly into our mother tongue. It was a slow process. The writing, a thin, slanted scribble, was hard to read.
"Where are you, my little Michelle? My beautiful Michelle? Where are you now? Would you remember me, Michelle? Me, Sarah, your sister. The one who never came back. The one who left you in the cupboard. The one who thought you'd be safe. Michelle, the years have gone by and I still have the key. The key to our secret hiding place. You see, I've kept it day after day, touching it, remembering you. It has never left me since July 16, 1942. No one here knows. No one here knows about the key, about you. About you in the cupboard. About mother, about father. About the camp. About summer 1942. About who I really am. Michelle, not one day has gone by without me thinking of you. Remembering 26, Rue de Saint-Ange. I carry the burden of your death like I would a child. I will carry it till the day I die. Sometimes I want to die. I cannot bear the weight of your death, of mother's death, of father's death. Visions of cattle trains carrying them to their deaths. I hear the train in my mind. I have heard it over and over again for the past 30 years. I cannot bear the weight of my past. Yet I cannot throw away the key to your cupboard. It is the only concrete thing that links me to you, apart from your grave. Michelle, how can I pretend I am someone else? How can I make them believe I am another woman? No, I cannot forget. The stadium, the camp, the train, Jules and Geneviève, Alain and Henriette, Nicolas and Gaspard. My child cannot make me forget. I love him. He is my son. My husband does not know who I am, what my story is, but I cannot forget. Coming here was a terrible mistake. I thought I could change. I thought I could put it all behind me, but I cannot. They went to Auschwitz. They were killed. My brother, he died in the cupboard. There is nothing left for me. I thought there was, but I was wrong. A child and a husband are not enough. They know nothing. They don't know who I am. They will never know. Michelle, in my dreams, you come and get me. You take me by the hand and you lead me away. This life is too much for me to bear. I look at the key and I long for you and for the past. For the innocent, easy days before the war. I know now my scars will never heal. I hope my son will forgive me. He will never know. No one will ever know. Zakor Al-Tika. Remember. Never forget. The cafe was a noisy, lively place, yet around William and me grew a bubble of total silence. I put the notebook down.
devastated at what we now knew.
She killed herself, William said flatly. There was no accident. She drove that car straight into the tree.
I said nothing. I could not speak. I did not know what to say. I wanted to reach out and take his hand, but something held me back. I took a deep breath, but still the words did not come. The brass key lay between us on the table, a silent witness of the past, of Michelle's death. I sensed him closing up, like he had done once before in Lucca, when he had held up his palms as if to push me away. He did not move, but I clearly felt him drawing away. Once again, I resisted the powerful, compulsive urge to touch him, to hold him. Why did I feel there was so much I could share with this man? Somehow he was no stranger to me, and more bizarre still, I felt even less a stranger to him. What had brought us together? My quest? My thirst for truth? My compassion for his mother? He knew nothing of me, knew nothing of my failing marriage, my near miscarriage in Lucca, my job, my life. What did I know of him, of his wife, his children, his career? His present was a mystery. But his past, his mother's past, had been etched out to me like fiery torches along a dark path. And I longed to show this man that I cared, that what happened to his mother had altered my life.
Thank you, he said at last. Thank you for telling me all this.
His voice seemed odd, contrived. I realized I had wanted him to break down, to cry, to show me some form of emotion. Why? No doubt because I myself needed release, needed tears to wash away pain, sorrow, emptiness, needed to share my feelings with him, in a particular, intimate communion. He was leaving, getting up from the table, gathering up the key and the notebook. I could not bear the idea of him going so soon. If he walked out now, I was convinced I would never hear from him again. He would not want to see me or talk to me. I would lose the last link to Sarah. I would lose him. And for some godforsaken, obscure reason, William Rainsford was the only person I wanted to be with at that very moment. He must have read something in my face because he hesitated, hovered over the table.
I will go to these places, he said. Bon-la-Roland and Rue Nélaton.
I could come with you if you want me to. His eyes rested upon me. Again, I perceived the contrast of what I knew I inspired in him, a complex bundle of resentment and thankfulness.
No, I prefer to go alone, but I'd appreciate it if you gave me the Dufour brothers' addresses. I'd like to see them, too.
Sure, I replied, looking at my agenda and scribbling the addresses down on a piece of paper for him. Suddenly he sat down again, heavily.
You know, I could do with a drink, he said.
Fine, of course, I said, signaling to the waiter. We ordered some wine for William and a fruit juice for me. As we drank in silence, I noticed inwardly how comfortable I felt with him. Two fellow Americans enjoying a quiet drink. Somehow we did not need to talk, and it did not feel awkward. But I knew that as soon as he had finished the last dregs of his wine, he'd be gone. The moment came.
Thank you, Julia. Thank you for everything.
He did not say, let's keep in touch. Send each other emails. Talk on the phone from time to time. No, he said nothing. But I knew what his silence spelled out, loud and clear. Don't call me. Don't contact me, please. I need to figure my entire life out. I need time and silence and peace. I need to find out who I now am. I watched him walk away under the rain, his tall figure fading into the busy street. I folded my palms over the roundness of my stomach, letting loneliness ebb into me.
When I came home that evening, I found the entire Thézac family waiting for me. They were sitting with Bertrand and Zoe in our living room. I immediately picked up the stiffness of the atmosphere. It appeared they had divided into two groups, Edouard, Zoe, and Cécile, who were on my side, approving of what I had done, and Colette and Laure, who disapproved. Bertrand said nothing, remaining strangely silent. His face was mournful, his mouth drooping at the sides. He did not look at me. "How could I have done such a thing?" Colette exploded. "Tracing that family, contacting that man, who in the end knew nothing of his mother's past."
"That poor man,"
echoed my sister-in-law, Laure, quivering.
"Imagine! Now he finds out who he really is. His mother was a Jew, his entire family wiped out in Poland, his uncle starved to death. Julia should have left him alone."
Edouard stood up abruptly, threw his hands into the air.
"My God!" he roared. "What has come of all this family?"
Zoe took shelter under my arm.
"Julia did something brave, something generous," he went on, quaking with anger. "She wanted to make sure that the little girl's family knew we cared, knew that my father cared enough to ensure Sarah Starzinski was looked after by a foster family, that she was loved."
"Oh, Father, please," interrupted Laure. "What Julia did was pathetic. Bringing back the past is never a good idea, especially whatever happened during the war. No one wants to be reminded of that. Nobody wants to think about that."
She did not look at me, but I perceived the full weight of her animosity. I read her mind easily. Just the sort of thing an American would do. No respect for the past. No idea of what a family secret is, no manners, no sensitivity. Uncouth, uneducated American. L'Américain avec ses gros sabots.
"I disagree," said Cécile, her voice shrill. "I'm glad you told me what happened, Père. It's a horrid story. That poor little boy dying in the apartment, the little girl coming back. I think Julia was right to contact that family. After all, we did nothing we should be ashamed of."
"Perhaps," said Colette, her lips pinched. "But if Julia had not been so nosy, Edouard would never have mentioned it. Right?"
Edouard faced his wife. His face was cold. So was his voice.
"Colette, my father made me promise I'd never reveal what happened. I respected his wish, with difficulty, for the past 60 years. But now I am glad you know. Now I can share this with you, even if it apparently disturbs some of you."
"Thank God Mamé knows nothing," sighed Colette,
patting her ash-blonde hair into place.
"Oh, Mamé knows," "She told me what happened. I didn't know about the little boy. I guess Mom didn't want me to hear that part. But Mamé told me all about it."
Zoe went on.
"She's known about it since it happened. The concierge told her Sarah came back. And she said Grandpère had all these nightmares about a dead child in his room. She said it was horrible, knowing, and never being able to talk about it with her husband, her son, and later with the family. She said it had changed my great-grandfather, that it had done something to him, something he could not talk about, even to her."
I looked at my father-in-law. He stared at my daughter, incredulous.
"Zoe, she knew? She's known about it all these years?"
Zoe nodded.
"Mamé said it was a dreadful secret to carry, that she never stopped thinking about the little girl. She said she was glad I now knew. She said we should have talked about it much earlier. We should have done what Mom did. We should not have waited. We should have found the little girl's family. We were wrong to have kept it hidden. That's what she told me, just before her stroke."
There was a long, painful silence. Zoe drew herself up. She gazed at Colette, Edouard, at her aunts, at her father, at me. "There's something else I want to tell you," she added, smoothly switching from French to English and accentuating her American accent. "I don't care what some of you think. I don't care if you think Mom was wrong, if you think Mom did something stupid. I'm really proud of what she did, how she found William, how she told him. You have no idea what it took, what it meant to her, what it means to me, and probably what it means to him. And you know what? When I grow up, I want to be like her. I want to be a mom my kids are proud of. Bonne nuit." She made a funny little bow, walked out of the room, and quietly closed the door. We remained in silence for a long time. I watched Colette's face grow stony, almost rigid. Laure checked her makeup in a pocket mirror. Cécile seemed petrified. Bertrand had not said one word. He was facing the window, hands joined behind his back. He had not looked at me once, or at any of us. Edouard got up, patted my head in a tender, paternal gesture. His pale blue eyes twinkled down at me. He murmured something in French, in the crook of my ear.
"You did the right thing. You did well."
But later on that evening, as I lay in my solitary bed, unable to read, to think, to do anything but lie back and examine the ceiling, I wondered. I thought of William, wherever he was, trying to fit the new pieces of his life together. I thought of the Tézac family, for once having to come out of their shell, for once having to communicate the sad, dark secret out in the open. I thought of Bertrand turning his back to me.
"Tu as fait ce qu'il fallait. Tu as bien fait,"
Edouard had said. Was Edouard right? I did not know. I wondered still. Zoe opened the door, crept into my bed like a long, silent puppy, nestling up to me. She took my hand, slowly kissed it, rested her head on my shoulder. I listened to the muffled roar of the traffic on the Boulevard de Montparnasse. It was getting late. Bertrand was with Amélie, no doubt. He felt so far from me, like a stranger, like somebody I hardly knew. Two families that I had brought together, just for today. Two families that would never be the same again. Had I done the right thing? I did not know what to think. I did not know what to believe. Zoe fell asleep next to me, her slow breath tickling my cheek. I thought of the child to come, and I felt a sort of peace come over me, a peaceful feeling that soothed me for a while. But the ache, the sadness remained. New York City, 2005.
"Zoe!" I yelled. "For God's sake, hold your sister's hand! She's going to fall off that thing and break her neck!"
My long-legged daughter scowled at me.
"You are one hell of a paranoid mother!"
She grabbed the baby's plump arm and shoved her back onto her tricycle. Her little legs pumped furiously along the track, Zoe hurtling behind her. The toddler gurgled with delight, craning her neck back to make sure I was watching, with the overt vanity of a 2-year-old. Central Park and the first tantalizing promise of spring. I stretched my legs out, tilted my face back to the sun. The man at my side caressed my cheek. Neil, my boyfriend, a trifle older than me, a lawyer, divorced. Lived in the Flatiron District with his teenage sons, introduced to me by my sister. I liked him. I wasn't in love with him, but I enjoyed his company. He was an intelligent, cultivated man. He had no intention of marrying me, thank God, and he put up with my daughters from time to time. There had been a couple of boyfriends since we had come to live here. Nothing serious, nothing important. Zoe called them my suitors, Charla, my beau, in scarlet-like fashion. Before Neil, the latest suitor, was called Peter. He had an art gallery,
a bald spot on the back of his head that pained him, and a drafty loft in Tribeca. They were decent, slightly boring, all-American middle-aged men. Polite, earnest, and meticulous. They had good jobs, they were well-educated, cultivated, and generally divorced. They came to pick me up, they dropped me off, they offered their arm and their umbrella. They took me out to lunch, to the Met, MoMA, the City Opera, the NYCB, to shows on Broadway, out to dinner, and sometimes to bed. I endured it. Sex was something I now did because I felt I had to. It was mechanical and dull. There, too, something had vanished. The passion, the excitement, the heat, all gone. I felt like someone, me, had fast-forwarded the film of my life, and there I appeared like a wooden Charlie Chaplin character, doing everything in a hasty and awkward way, as if I had no other choice, a stiff grin pasted on my face, acting like I was happy with my new life. Sometimes Sharla would steal a look at me and say, "Hey, you okay?" She would nudge me, and I'd mumble, "Oh, sure, fine." She did not seem convinced, but for the moment, she let me be. My mother, too, would let her eyes roam over my face and purse her lips with worry. "Everything all right, sugar?" I'd shrug away her anxiety with a careless smile. A glorious, crisp New York morning. The kind you never get in Paris. Sharp, fresh air. Stark blue sky. The city's skyline hemming us in above the trees. The Dakota's pale mass facing us. The smell of hot dogs and pretzels wafting through the breeze. I reached out my hand and stroked Neil's knee, eyes still closed against the sun's increasing heat. New York and its fierce, contrasted weather, sizzling summers, freezing white winters, and the light that fell over the city, a hard, bright, silvery light that I had grown to love. Paris and its damp, gray drizzle seemed to come from another world. I opened my eyes and watched my daughters cavort. Overnight, or so it seemed, Zoe had sprouted into a spectacular teenager, towering over me with lissome, strong limbs. She looked like Sharla and Bertrand. She'd inherited their class, their allure, their charm, that feisty, powerful combination of Jarmont and Tézac that enchanted me. The little one was something else. Softer, rounder, more fragile. She needed cuddling, kissing, more fuss and attention than Zoe had demanded at her age. Was it because her father was not around? Because Zoe, the baby, and I had left France for New York not long after the birth? I did not know. I did not question myself too much. It had been strange, coming back to live in America after many years in Paris. It still felt strange sometimes. It did not yet feel like home. I wondered how long that would take. But it had happened. There had been difficulty. It had not been an easy decision to make. The baby's birth had been premature, a cause for panic and pain. She was born just after Christmas, 2 months before her due date. I underwent a gruesomely long C-section in the emergency room at Saint-Vincent-de-Paul Hospital. Bertrand had been there, oddly tense, moved despite himself. A tiny, perfect little girl. Had he been disappointed? I wondered. I wasn't. This child meant so much to me. I had fought for her. I had not given in. She was my victory. Shortly after the birth, and just before the move to the Rue de Saint-Ange, Bertrand summoned up the courage to tell me he loved Amélie, that he wanted to live with her from now on, that he wanted to move into the Trocadéro apartment with her, that he could no longer lie to me, to Zoe, that there would have to be a divorce, but it could be quick and easy. It was then, watching him go through with his long-winded, complicated confession, watching him pace the room up and down, his hands behind his back, his eyes downcast, that the first idea of moving to America dawned upon me. I listened to Bertrand till the end. He looked drained, wrecked,
but he had done it. He had been honest with me at last, and honest with himself, and I had looked back at my handsome, sensual husband and thanked him. He had seemed surprised. He admitted he had expected a stronger, more bitter reaction. Shouts, insults, a fuss. The baby in my arms had moaned, waving her tiny fists.
"No fuss," I said. "No shouts, no insults, all right?"
"All right," he said, and he kissed me and the baby. He already felt like he was out of my life, like he had already left. That night, every time I rose to feed the hungry child, I thought of the States.
Boston?
No, I hated the idea of going back to the past, to my childhood city. And then I knew. New York. Zoe, the baby, and I could go to New York. Charla was there, my parents not far. New York, why not? I didn't know the city all that well. I had never lived there for a long spell, apart from my annual visits to my sisters. New York. Perhaps the only city that could rival Paris because of its complete and utter difference. The more I thought about it, the more the idea secretly appealed to me. I didn't talk it over with my friends. I knew Hervé, Christophe, Guillaume, Susanna, Holly, Jan, and Isabel would be upset at the idea of my departure. But I knew they would understand and accept it, too. And then Mamay had died. She had lingered on since her stroke in November. She had never been able to speak again, although she had regained consciousness. She had been moved to the intensive care unit at the Cochin Hospital. I was expecting her death, gearing myself up to face it, but it still came as a shock. It was after the funeral, which took place in Burgundy, in the sad little graveyard, that Zoe had said to me,
"Mom, do we have to go live in the Rue de Saint-Ange?"
"I think your father expects us to."
"But do you want to go live there?" she asked.
"No," I said truthfully. "Ever since I've known what happened there, I don't want to."
"I don't want to either."
Then she said,
"But where could we move to then, Mom?"
And I replied, lightly, jokingly, expecting her to snort with disapproval, "Well, how about New York City?" It had been as easy as that with Zoe. Bertrand had not been happy about our decision, about his daughter moving so far away. But Zoe was firm about leaving. She said she'd come back every couple of months, and Bertrand could come over, too, to see her and the baby. I explained to Bertrand that there was nothing set, nothing definitive about the move. It wasn't forever. It was just for a couple of years, to let Zoe grasp the American side of her, to help me move on, to start something new. He had now established himself with Amélie. They formed a couple, an official one. Amélie's children were nearly adults. They lived away from home and also spent time with their father. Was Bertrand tempted by the prospect of a new life without the everyday responsibility of children, his or hers, to raise on a daily basis? Perhaps. He finally said yes. And then I got things going. After an initial stay at her house, Charla had helped me find a place to live. A simple, white two-bedroom apartment with an open city view and a doorman on West 86th Street, between Amsterdam and Columbus. I sublet it from one of her friends who had moved to Los Angeles. The building was full of families and divorced parents, a noisy beehive of babies, kids, bikes, strollers, scooters. It was a comfortable, cozy home, but there, too, something was missing. What? I could not tell. Thanks to Joshua, I'd been hired as the New York City correspondent for a hip French website. I worked from home and still used Bamber as a photographer when I needed shots from Paris. There had been a new school for Zoe, Trinity College, a couple of blocks away.
"Mom, I'll never fit in. Now they call me the Frenchie,"
she complained, and I couldn't help smiling. New Yorkers were fascinating to watch. Their purposeful step, their banter, their friendliness. My neighbors said hi in the elevator. had offered us flowers and candy when we moved in, and joked with the doorman. I had forgotten about all that. I was so used to Parisian surliness and people living on the same doorstep, barely giving each other curt nods in the staircase. Perhaps the most ironic thing about it all was that despite the exciting whirlwind of a life I now had, I missed Paris. I missed the Eiffel Tower lighting up on the hour, every evening, like a shimmering, bejeweled seductress. I missed the air sirens howling over the city, every first Wednesday at noon, for their monthly drill. I missed the Saturday outdoor market along the boulevard Edgar Quinet, where the vegetable man called me Ma Petite Dame, although I was probably his tallest feminine customer. Like Zoe, I felt I was a Frenchie too, despite being American. Leaving Paris had not been as easy as I had anticipated. New York and its energy, its clouds of steam billowing from its manholes, its vastness, its bridges, its buildings, its gridlock, was still not home. I missed my Parisian friends, even if I'd made some great new ones here. I missed Edouard, who I had become close to, and who wrote to me monthly. I especially missed the way French men check women out, what Holly used to call their naked look. I had gotten used to it over there, but now in Manhattan, there were only cheerful bus drivers to yell, "Yo Slim!" at Zoe and "Yo Blondie!" at me. I felt like I had become invisible. Why did my life feel so empty, I wondered. As if a hurricane had hit it. As if the bottom had dropped out of it. And the nights. Nights were forlorn, even those I spent with Neil. Lying in bed listening to the sounds of the great pulsating city and letting the images come back to me, like the tide creeping up the beach. Sarah. She never left me. She had changed me forever. Her story, her suffering. I carried them within me. I felt as if I knew her. I knew her as a child, as a young girl, as the 40-year-old housewife who crashed her car into a tree on an icy New England road. I could see her face perfectly, the slanted green eyes, the shape of her head, her posture, her hands, her rare smile. I knew her. I could have stopped her on the street, had she still been alive. Zoe was a sharp one. She had caught me red-handed, Googling William Rainsford. I had not realized she was back from school. One winter afternoon, she had sneaked in without me hearing her. "How long have you been doing this?" she asked, sounding like a mother coming across her teenager smoking pot. Flushed, I admitted that I'd looked him up regularly in the past year. "And?" she went on, arms crossed, frowning down at me. "Well, it appears he has left Luca," I confessed. "Oh, where is he then?" "He's back in the States. Has been for a couple of months." I could no longer bear her stare, so I stood up and went to the window, glancing down to busy Amsterdam Avenue. "Is he in New York, Mom?" Her voice was softer now, less harsh. She came up behind me, put her lovely head on my shoulder. I nodded. I could not face telling her how excited I'd been when I found out he was here, too. How thrilled, how amazed I'd felt about ending up in the same city as him, 2 years after our last meeting. His father was a New Yorker, I recalled. He had probably lived here as a little boy. He was listed in the phone book, in the West Village, a mere 15-minute subway ride from here. And for days, for weeks, I had agonizingly asked myself whether I should call him or not. He had never tried to contact me since Paris. I had never heard from him since then. The excitement had petered out after a while. I did not have the courage to call him. But I went on thinking about him, night after night, day after day, in secret, in silence. I wondered if I'd ever run into him one day, in the park, in some department store, bar, restaurant. Was he here with his wife and girls? Why had he come back to the States like I had? What had happened?
Have you contacted him? Zoe asked.
No.
Will you?
I don't know, Zoe. I started to cry silently.
Oh, Mom, please,
she sighed. I wiped the tears away angrily, feeling foolish.
Mom, he knows you live here now. I'm sure he knows. He's looked you up as well. He knows what you do here. He knows where you live.
That thought had never occurred to me. William Googling me. William checking out my address. Was Zoe right? Did he know I lived in New York City, too, on the Upper West Side? Did he ever think of me? What did he feel exactly when he did?
You have to let go, Mom. You have to put it behind you. Call Neil, see him more often, just get on with your life.
I turned to her, my voice ringing out loud and harsh.
I can't, Zoe. I need to know if what I did helped him. I need to know that. Is that too much to ask? Is that such an impossible thing?
The baby wailed from the next room. I'd disturbed her nap. Zoe went to get her and came back with her plump, hiccuping sister. Zoe stroked my hair gently over the toddler's curls.
I don't think you'll ever know, Mom. I don't think he'll ever be ready to tell you. You changed his life. You turned it upside down, remember? He probably never wants to see you again.
I plucked the child from her arms and pressed her fiercely against me, relishing her warmth, her plumpness. Zoe was right. I needed to turn the page, to get on with my life. How was another matter. I kept myself busy. I did not have a minute to myself, what with Zoe, her sister, Neil, my parents, my nephews, my job, and the never-ending string of parties Sharla and her husband Barry invited me to, and to which I relentlessly went. I met more new people in 2 years than I had in my entire Parisian stay, a cosmopolitan melting pot that I reveled in. Yes, I had left Paris for good, but whenever I returned for my work or to see my friends or Edouard, I always found myself in the Marais, drawn back again and again, as if my footsteps could not help bringing me there. Rue des Rosiers, Rue du Roi de Sicile, Rue des Écouffes, Rue de Saint-Ange, Rue de Bretagne. I saw them file past with new eyes, eyes that remembered what had happened here in 1942, even if it had been long before my time. I wondered who lived in the Rue de Saint-Ange apartment now, who stood by the window overlooking the leafy courtyard, who ran their palm along the smooth marble mantelpiece. I wondered if the new tenants had any inkling that a little boy had died within their home, and that a young girl's life had been changed that day forever. In my dreams, I went back to the Marais, too. In my dreams, sometimes the horrors of the past that I had not witnessed appeared to me with such starkness that I had to turn on the light in order to drive the nightmare away. It was during those sleepless, empty nights when I lay in bed, jaded by the social talk, dry-mouthed after the extra glass of wine I should not have given in to, that the old ache came back and haunted me. His eyes, his face when I had read Sarah's letter out loud. It all came back and drove sleep away, delving into me. Zoe's voice dragged me back to Central Park, the beautiful spring day, and Neil's hand on my thigh.
Mom, this monster wants a popsicle.
No way, I said. No popsicle. The baby threw herself face forward on the grass and bawled.
Quite something, isn't she? Mused Neil.
January 2005 also brought me back, again and again, to Sarah, to William. The importance of the 60th commemoration of Auschwitz's liberation made every headline around the world. It seemed that never before had the word Shoah been pronounced so often. And every time I heard it, my thoughts leaped painfully to him, to her. And I wondered, as I watched the Auschwitz memorial ceremony on TV, if William ever thought of me when he, too, heard the word. When he, too, saw the monstrous black-and-white images of the past flicker across the screen. The lifeless skeletal bodies piled high. The crematoriums, the ashes, the horror of it all. His family had died in that hideous place. His mother's parents. How could he not think of it, I mused. On the screen, with Zoe and Sharla at my side, I watched the snowflakes fall on the camp, the barbed wire, the squat watchtower, the crowd, the speeches, the prayers, the candles, the Russian soldiers and their particular dancing gait, and the final, unforgettable vision of nightfall, and the railway tracks aflame, glowing through the darkness with a poignant, sharp mixture of grief and remembrance. The call came one May afternoon, when I was least expecting it. I was at my desk, struggling with the new computer's whims. I picked up the phone, my yes sounding curt even to me.
Hi, this is William Rainsford.
I sat up straight, heart aflutter, trying to remain calm. William Rainsford. I said nothing, dumbstruck, clutching the receiver to my ear.
You there, Julia?
I swallowed. Yes, just having some computer problems. How are you, William?
Fine, he said.
A little silence. But it did not feel tense or strived. It's been a while, I said lamely.
Yes, it has, he said.
Another silence.
I see you're a New Yorker now, he said at last. Looked you up.
So Zoe had been right after all.
Well, how about getting together?
He asked. Today? I said.
If you can make it.
I thought of the sleeping child in the next room. She had been to daycare this morning, but I could take her along. She wasn't going to like having her nap interrupted, though. I can make it, I said.
Great. I'll ride up to your part of town. Got any ideas where we could meet?
Do you know Cafe Mozart on West 70th Street and Broadway?
I know it. Fine. See you there in half an hour?
I hung up. My heart was beating so fast I could hardly breathe. I went to wake the baby, ignored her protests, bundled her up, unfolded the stroller, and took off. He was already there when we arrived. I saw his back first, the powerful shoulders, and his hair, silver and thick, no longer bearing any trace of blonde. He was reading a newspaper, but he swiveled around as I approached, as if he could feel my eyes upon him. Then he was up on his feet, and there was an awkward, amusing moment when we didn't know whether to shake hands or kiss. He laughed, I did too, and he finally hugged me, a great big bear hug, slamming my chin against his collarbone and patting the small of my back, and then he bent down to admire my daughter.
"What a beautiful little girl," he crooned.
She solemnly handed him her favorite rubber giraffe.
"And what's your name, then?"
he asked.
"Luthy,"
she lisped. "That's the giraffe's name," I began. But William had already started to press the toy, and loud squeaks drowned out my voice, making the baby shriek with glee. We found a table and sat down, keeping the child in her stroller. He glanced at the menu.
"Ever had the Amadeus cheesecake?"
he asked, raising one eyebrow. "Yes," I said. "It's positively diabolical." He grinned.
"Hey, you look fabulous, Julia. New York certainly suits you."
I blushed like a teenager, imagining Zoe looking on and rolling her eyes. Then his mobile rang. He answered it. I could tell by his expression it was a woman. I wondered who. His wife? One of his daughters? The conversation went on. He seemed flustered. I bent over the child, playing with the giraffe.
Sorry, he said, tucking the phone away. That was my girlfriend.
Oh. I must have sounded confused because he snorted with laughter.
I'm divorced now, Julia.
He looked straight at me. His face sobered.
You know, after you told me, everything changed.
At last. At last he was telling me what I needed to know. The aftermath. The consequences. I did not quite know what to say. I was afraid that if I uttered one word, he'd stop. I kept busy with my daughter, handing her her bottle of water, making sure she didn't spill it all over herself, fumbling with a paper napkin. The waitress came to take our orders. 2 Amadeus cheesecakes, 2 coffees, and a pancake for the child. William said,
"Everything went to pieces. It was hell. A terrible year."
We said nothing for a couple of minutes, looking around us at the busy tables. The cafe was a noisy, bright place, with classical music emanating from hidden speakers. The child cooed to herself, smiling up at me and at William, brandishing her toy. The waitress brought us our food. "Are you okay now?" I asked tentatively.
"Yes," he said swiftly. "Yes, I am. It took me a while to get used to this new part of me, to understand and accept my mother's history, to deal with the pain of it. Sometimes I still can't, but I work at it, hard. I did a couple of very necessary things."
"Like what?" I asked, feeding sticky bits of crumbled pancake to my daughter.
"I realized I could no longer bear all this alone. I felt isolated, broken. My wife could not understand what I was going through, and I just could not explain. The communication between us was non-existent. I took my daughters to Auschwitz with me last year, before the 60th anniversary celebration. I needed to tell them what had happened to their great-grandparents. It wasn't easy, and that was the only way I could do it, showing them. It was a moving, tearful trip, but I felt at peace at last, and I felt my daughters understood."
His face was sad, thoughtful. I did not speak. I let him do the talking. I wiped the baby's face and gave her more water.
"I did one last thing in January. I went back to Paris. There's a new Holocaust memorial in the Marais. Maybe you know that."
I nodded. I had heard of it and planned to go there on my next trip.
"Chirac inaugurated it at the end of January. There's a wall of names just by the entrance. A huge gray stone wall, engraved with 76,000 names, the names of every single Jew deported from France."
I watched his fingers play with the rim of his coffee cup. I felt it hard to look him fully in the face.
"I went there to find their names, and there they were. Vladislav and Rivka Starzinski, my grandparents. I felt the same peace I had found at Auschwitz, the same pain. I felt grateful that they were remembered, that the French remembered them and honored them this way. There were people crying in front of that wall, Julia. Old people, young people, people my age, touching the wall with their hands and crying."
He paused, breathed carefully through his mouth. I kept my eyes on the cup, on his fingers. The baby's giraffe squeaked, but we hardly heard it.
"Chirac gave a speech. I did not understand it, of course. I looked it up later on the internet and read the translation. A good speech. Urging people to remember France's responsibility during the Veldiv roundup and what followed. Chirac pronounced the same words my mother had written at the end of her letter. Zakor al-Tikva. Remember. Never forget. In Hebrew."
He bent down and retrieved a large manila envelope from the backpack at his feet. He handed it to me.
"These are my photos of her. I wanted to show them to you. I suddenly realized I didn't know who my mother was, Julia. I mean, I knew what she looked like. I knew her face, her smile.
but nothing about her inner life.
I wiped the maple syrup off my fingers in order to be able to handle them. Sarah on her wedding day. Tall, slender, her small smile, her secret eyes. Sarah cradling William as a baby. Sarah with William as a toddler, holding him by the hand. Sarah in her 30s, wearing an emerald ball dress. And Sarah just before her death, a large color close-up. Her hair was gray, I noticed. Prematurely gray and oddly becoming, like his now.
I remember her as being tall and slim and silent, said William as I looked at each photo with growing emotion. She didn't laugh much, but she was an intense person, a loving mother. But no one ever mentioned suicide after her death, ever. Not even Dad. I guess Dad never read the notebook. No one did. Maybe he found it a long time after her death. We all thought it was an accident. No one knew who my mother was, Julia. Not even me. And that's what I still find so hard to live with. What brought her to her death on that cold, snowy day. How she made that decision. Why we never knew anything about her past. Why she chose not to tell my father. Why she kept all her suffering, all her pain to herself.
These are beautiful pictures, I said at last. Thank you for bringing them. I paused. There's something I must ask you, I said, putting the photos away, gathering courage and looking at him at last.
Go ahead.
No harsh feelings against me? I asked with a weak smile. I've been feeling like I destroyed your life. He grinned.
No harsh feelings, Julia. I just needed to think. To understand. To put all the pieces back together. It took a while. That's why you never heard from me during all that time.
I felt relief sweep over me.
But I knew where you were all along, he smiled. Spent quite some time keeping track of you.
Mom, he knows you live here now. He's looked you up as well. He knows what you do here. He knows where you live.
When did you move to New York exactly?
He asked. A little while after the baby was born, spring 2003.
Why did you leave Paris, if you don't mind telling me?
I gave a rueful half-smile. My marriage had fallen apart. I'd just had this baby. I couldn't bring myself to live in the Rue de Saint-Ange apartment after everything that had happened there. And I felt like moving back to the States.
So how did you actually do it?
We stayed with my sister for a while on the Upper East Side. Then she found me a place to sublet from one of her friends. And my ex-boss found me a great job. What about you?
Same story. Life and Luca just didn't seem possible. And my wife and I...
His voice trailed off. He made a little gesture with his fingers as if to say, farewell, bye-bye.
I lived here as a boy, before Roxbury, and the idea had been passing through my head for a while. So I finally got around to it. I stayed at first with one of my oldest friends in Brooklyn. Then I found a place in the village. I do the same job here, food critic.
William's phone rang. The girlfriend again. I turned away, trying to give him the privacy he needed. He finally put the phone down.
She's a little possessive, he said, sheepishly. I think I'll turn it off for a while.
He fumbled with the phone. How long have you been together?
A couple of months.
He looked at me.
What about you? Are you seeing someone?
Yes, I am. I thought of Neil's courteous, bland smile. His careful gestures, the routine sex. I nearly added it was not important, that it was just for the company, because I could not stand being alone, because every night I thought of him, William, and of his mother, every single night for the past 2.5 years, but I kept my mouth shut. I just said, he's a nice person, divorced, a lawyer. William ordered fresh coffee. As he poured out mine, I noticed once again the beauty of his hands, his long, tapered fingers.
About 6 months after our last meeting, he said, I went back to the Rue de Saint-Ange. I had to see you, to talk to you. I didn't know where to reach you. I had no number for you and couldn't remember your husband's name, so I couldn't even look you up in the phone book. I thought you'd still be living there. I had no idea you'd moved.
He paused, ran a hand through his thick, silver hair.
I read all about the Veldiv roundup. I'd been to Bon-la-Rolande and to the street the stadium was on. I'd been to see Gaspard and Nicolas Dufour. They took me to my uncle's grave, in the Orléans cemetery. Such kind men. But it was difficult, hard to go through, and I wish you'd been there with me. I should never have done all that alone. I should have said yes when you asked to come along.
Maybe I should have insisted, I said.
I should have listened to you. It was too much to bear alone. And then, when I finally went back to the Rue de Saint-Ange, and when those unknown people opened your door, I felt you'd let me down.
He lowered his eyes. I set my coffee cup back in its saucer, resentment sweeping through me. How could he, I thought. After all I'd done for him, after all the time, the effort, the pain, the emptiness. He must have deciphered something in my face because he quickly put his hand on my sleeve.
I'm sorry I said that,
he murmured. I never let you down, William. My voice sounded stiff.
I know that, Julia. I'm sorry.
His was deep, vibrant. I relaxed, managed a smile. We sipped in silence. Sometimes our knees brushed against each other under the table. It felt natural, being with him. As if we'd been doing this for years. As if this was not just the third time in our lives we were seeing each other.
Is your ex-husband okay about you living here with the kids?
He asked. I shrugged. I looked down at the child who'd fallen asleep in her stroller. It wasn't easy, but he's in love with someone else. Has been for some time. That helped. He doesn't see the girls much, though. He comes here from time to time, and Zoe spends her vacations in France.
Same thing with my ex-wife. She's had a new child, a boy. I go to Lucca as often as I can to see my daughters. Or they come here, but more rarely. They're quite grown up now.
How old are they?
Stefania's 21 and Justina 19.
I whistled. You sure had them young.
Too young, maybe.
I don't know, I said. I sometimes feel awkward with the baby. I wish I'd had her earlier. There's such a gap between her and Zoe.
She's a sweet baby,
he said, taking a healthy bite out of his cheesecake. Yes, she is. The apple of her doting mother's eye. We both chuckled.
Do you miss not having a boy?
He asked. No, I don't. Do you?
No. I love my girls. Maybe they'll have grandsons, though. She's called Lucy, then?
I glanced across at him, then down at her. No, that's the toy giraffe, I said. There was a little pause. Her name is Sarah, I said quietly. He stopped chewing, put his fork down. His eyes changed. He looked at me, at the sleeping child, said nothing. Then he buried his face in his hands. He remained like that for minutes. I did not know what to do. I touched his shoulder. Silence. I felt guilty again. Felt as if I had done something unforgivable. But I had known all along this baby was to be called Sarah. As soon as I had been told it was a girl, at the moment of her birth, I had known her name. There was no other name my daughter could have had. She was Sarah, my Sarah, an echo to the other one, to the other Sarah, to the little girl with the yellow star who had changed my life. At last he drew his hands away and I saw his face, wrecked, beautiful. The acute sadness, the emotion in his eyes. He was not afraid of letting me see them. He did not fight the tears. It seemed that he wanted me to see it all, the beauty and ache of his life.
He wanted me to see his thanks, his gratitude, his pain. I took his hand and pressed it hard. I could not bear to look at him any longer, so I closed my eyes and put his hand against my cheek. I cried with him. I felt his fingers grow wet with my tears, but I kept his hand there. We sat there for a long time, till the crowd around us thinned, till the sun shifted and the light changed, till we felt our eyes could meet again, without the tears. This is Polly Stone. We hope you've enjoyed this production of Sarah's Key by Tatiana de Rene. This audiobook was produced and directed by Lisa Bainey. Executive producer was Laura Wilson. Text copyright 2007 by Tatiana de Rene. Production copyright 2008 by Macmillan Audio. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.